Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Welcome to the Democracy Ideas podcast, hosted by the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance here in Stockholm. Today, we have Owen Gaffney. Owen is Head of Impact at the Nobel Prize Outreach and co-author of Earth for All, a Survival Guide for Humanity, which was published in October of last year. And I hear doing very well in terms of sales and reviews from what I've seen. Owen is also a bit of a jack of all trades in the sustainability world. He's a writer, communication strategist, a producer, an analyst, on all the kind of issues related to, I think, climate change and sustainability and the future of our planet, joining, I think, a lot of dotted lines between politics, technology and science. And was formerly part of the Stockholm Resilience Centre and the Potsdam Institute in Germany. Welcome, Owen.
Thanks, Alistair. Great to be here.
Let's just talk about your book, which, as you say, has been published last year to very good reviews and some debate, I see, in the likes of Swedish newspapers. Could you just explain how the idea for the book came about and perhaps what are the main messages or the main thesis behind the book?
Right. So really, we're in the midst of a polycrisis. I mean, if we use that term, the latest buzzword on things, we have this confluence of influences and impacts on the world. And this is, we have climate change, we have the war in Ukraine, we're the global pandemic, we have a biodiversity crisis, and now we're facing, a cost of living crisis, we're facing a food crisis and energy crisis. And, this all comes on the back of 10 years of austerity after the global financial crisis. So we're getting these waves and waves of crises, and we don't seem to be able to get ourselves out of this, even though the world has never been so rich. We're the wealthiest the planet's ever been, but we still aren't resilient to these types of shocks. So we wanted to look at that, and we wanted to look at what's going to happen in the future. How's that going to evolve this century? Can things get better? Can we stay within planetary boundaries, or will things get worse? And what would it take for things to improve? So that's what we were looking for. And in many of these discussions, we all know we have to deal with climate change, and we know the solutions to it. And we know inequality is a problem. We know poverty is a problem. We know gender empowerment is a problem. We know our food system is really messed up, and we need to change the food system. But how do we do that? How do we actually make that kind of progress we need to make? So what we wanted to do was take a systems view at the problem and a systems view at the solution. What are the kind of solutions that at scale will get us to where we want to go this century? And so our basic foundation point is really the limits to growth analysis 50 years ago, the first system dynamics model that looked at the global economy and looked at the global economy and its impact on pollution, on the environment. And when that was published 50 years ago, that was a real wake-up call to the world, I think, and it still generates debate to this day. Because several of the scenarios they looked at showed that if we continue on our trajectory, then there's a very high risk of collapse sometime this century, early this century, in fact. And then when you look at actually how well the world, or how the world is tracking the trajectories pointed out, discussed in Limits to Growth in those scenarios, you find that we are actually we're tracking very closely to those doomsday scenarios, and that's really worrying. That's concerning. We're moving in the wrong direction. So we wanted to look at. So we built a new model, and we worked with Jürgen Randers, who was one of the original authors of Limits to Growth, to develop a new model which we called Earth for All. And that new model is really an economic model that is optimized for well-being. And we wanted to look at how societies could evolve this century, and how well-being could be prioritized and planetary boundaries be priorities, and can we all live a good life within planetary boundaries. So that was really the key foundation there.
One of the things I saw you when you were talking about your book, you recently published a piece in the Project Syndicate where you had said redistributing wealth is needed to rebuild trust in democratic systems, which is essential to broaden political support for bold decisions. And I think what we mean by bold decisions are the bold decisions that you're talking about that are needed going forward to avoid, to keep within these planetary boundaries and avoid the kind of the kind of doomsday scenario that was talked about at first 50 years ago. And perhaps could you elaborate a bit how you see this link that you talk a lot about in your book between this redistribution of wealth and the importance of pushing some kind of democratic change towards climate change policies?
Yeah, so democracy everywhere is under threat. You know, we are we're seeing a rise of authoritarian leaders. We're seeing a slide back from democracy, and IDEA has done the foundational research in this and published the data on the scale of the shifts. So one big question we were asking is, well, what will happen this century, regarding democracy and social tensions? You know, and we can see that if we stay on the economic path we're on, then we can see that social tensions are likely to rise. They've been rising over the last few decades, and in many once stable countries, and we can see them rising in the future. And what creates a stable democracy is there's many things, there's many factors that go into it. But one thing that we can see that goes into it is the level of income and wealth inequality in a country. That it's one of the ways to polarize. It's an easy way to polarize, and it's an easy way for authoritarian or populist leaders to start gaining support by emphasizing those economic divisions. And of course, there's a very, very obvious link as well to between inequality, wealth inequality and democracy. And that is, democracy is really a good democracy. Everybody feels that their vote counts, that they are represented. But money delivers power. Money gives power to people. And in very unequal countries, the wealthy just have more influence and more power with the governments and parliaments, and we can see that. And people see that. People sense a sense of unfairness there. So that is going to contribute, to destabilizing societies. But the key thing is, if we want to tackle the grand challenges this century, if we value democracy and we want to tackle those challenges, we need governments to make bold decisions, to take make big changes, big investments when it comes to energy, when it comes to food systems change, for example. And so to actually empower governments to do that, people must feel that they're getting something out of it, that this is good for them. The governments are working for them. So we feel that increased redistribution of wealth is a key way of signifying that that the democracies are working for people. And of course, the transformation is going to be disruptive. So we need to create security, social security systems to help people through that disruption and to feel that, and for them to know they're valued. And again, redistribution of wealth can help do that. That can provide the investments needed for that kind of security.
I think a lot of people, when they talk about climate change, kind of think, let's rely on the likes of the multilateral fora such as, right, the COPs. Let's rely on a bit of technology. Let's rely on these national commitments that we hear about. Let's rely on these big companies promising to be green by 2030 or net zero by 2050. So I guess what you're saying is that's not enough, that we need something more profounder politically than just these kind of promises and fora.
Well, you know, we need technological changes without doubt, but we also need social changes and economic changes at a huge scale. I mean, so the technological changes on their own won't be enough. And as we saw during the energy crisis this year and last year in Europe, to be able to, you know, to really change rapidly our energy demand, to lower that energy demand, did that come from technological change or did it come from social change? You know, it all came from social change. If you wanted really, really rapid change, then you know, asking people to turn down their thermostat 1 degree or to work from home, it's these kinds of to cut down on meat in their diets. It's these kind of changes that that people can do themselves very quickly, and that can have the biggest short-term impact, rather than, you know, waiting for years to put in get electric cars and have the infrastructure for that, which is even though that can happen very, very rapidly, it also takes some time. So basically, I mean, the kinds of changes we're talking about as well, they're system-wide changes. So we need that individual shifts, personal behavioural change, but also the full system-wide change. And I think we're not getting that change at the moment at the scale we need, because there isn't a big enough coalition of the willing, calling and pushing for that change. That's clearly obvious in democratic countries. There just isn't a big enough groundswell, even after, you know, some of the big social movements over the last few years, the Fridays for Future, Extinction Rebellion, and others. It hasn't converted into the kind of scale that we really need for the kind of transition we need. And just as a reminder, actually, with the speed we need to change, the multilateral processes, the Paris Agreement that signed us up to aim for 1.5 degrees Celsius. Only last year we heard that even 1.5 is a high risk temperature to reach, because we're likely to cross four tipping points in the Earth's system related to things like the West Antarctic Ice Sheet and the Greenland Ice Sheet, which have enough water in them to raise sea levels by 10 meters. We're likely to cross those tipping points at 1.5 and drive that irreversible change over several centuries. And so, but our carbon budget for 1.5 will be exhausted in 77 months. So we'll have no carbon budget left for a stable planet in within 77 months. So we're using the budget at over 1% per year. So the transformation required is huge. You know, we will overshoot 1.5. We will need to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So this, we'll need these huge industrial and social changes to be able to manage that. And if we value democracy, you know, we have to strengthen democracy to empower those systems to drive this kind of change at scale.
I mean, well, you talked about tipping points, and I think we talk about tipping points, as you say, in terms of this, the Antarctic having irreversible melting, etc. But you also talk about social tipping points and the idea that we're passing the point of no return in many ways, in perhaps public's perceptions or protest movements or political movements for change. Do you see more evidence of that kind of social tipping points in terms of behavior or in terms of political stances? you know, whether that's in developing countries or in Europe or in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, so this is where I get quite optimistic about things. So, not, you know, in the book we talk about, you know, that we can do it, that the window is still open to act, and we can act at scale. And we talk about, you know, driving towards a relatively stable planet, because there's some changes that we're just not going to be able to avoid anymore. But we do see social tipping points, and I think social tipping points are what's needed now to really drive change. And we can see them in four areas. We can see in the technological side of things that a lot of the you know, new technologies are going mainstream very, very quickly. They're scaling. You know, wind and solar have now become mainstream without doubt. Electric vehicles is a great example of going mainstream, and we can expect a complete transformation to potentially 80-90% of new cars are electric by 2030, which is remarkable. But that's the kind of scale of change we can we're now seeing in the pathways. So then there's the economic tipping points, whereas basically there's the most profound tipping point is that it's cheaper to produce electricity with solar and wind than it is with coal and other fossil fuels, and there's no going back once that's happened. That's an irreversible tipping point. And in fact, solar is now the cheapest form of energy in the history of civilization. So that's without doubt a tipping point there. And then with these movements, I mentioned, you know, the Fridays for Future and Extinction Rebellion and others. I mean, we are seeing a huge groundswell of support there, and that needs to keep growing really before we fully hit a tipping point with that. And on the political side, you know, we can see in Germany, you know, the rise of the Green Party there. We can see that change can happen very, very rapidly. And we can see in the UK, for example, the you know, both left and right coming together around policies on net zero by 2050, and so this in some ways, you know, I'm surprised about the political momentum and how fast we've gone from sort of less ambitious targets to net zero by 2050 in many, many countries now. So that in some ways is a tipping point, but it's still not enough. We need to go as the dangers, the scale of the dangers become more apparent as Earth system scientists, you know, study these tipping points and publish the research on this. As that danger becomes more apparent, it's we can see that the risks become even higher, and the transformation needs to be faster. And so, again, getting back to democracy, you know, how do we empower democracies to make that that kind of change?
I would say that in many ways, often democracy gets short shrift, I think, sometimes, both from some climate scientists, but also obviously from political leaders. So, you know, you can sometimes hear some climate scientists will say, look, you know, it's not about democracy. We just, the situation is such an emergency, it's such a crisis that whatever can be done has to be done to save the planet. Some I've heard people kind of point to the kind of not with admiration, but with a kind of grudging acceptance that the likes of Chinese, you know, authoritarian rule may be eventually the only way that we manage to do anything, rather like the COVID policies and locking people up in their, you know, in their houses was needed, that we'll probably end up doing that. Do you think there's a danger, as you just said, that the risk of these tipping points becomes greater for every year of inaction, that somehow democracy starts to play second fiddle for the needs of what people say is an emergency? And I think if you look at some of the, you know, the rhetoric from the likes of even Greta Thunberg, but obviously Extinction Rebellion, that this really is an emergency. How do you square that sometimes with democracies? Is there a risk that somehow we could go down the wrong road to make these transformational changes that are needed?
I think there is a very, very big risk. But I'm a huge believer in the power of democracy to actually drive the changes that we want. And in fact, democracies are the most innovative forms of government there are. So if you want rapid innovation, it's in a sort of democratic system you really want to be to be operating within. So absolutely, I think. But the risk is there. So how do we minimize that risk, and how do we and challenge that narrative as well? You know, democracies can evolve to be dynamic, to be responsive to these needs, to work together. Political parties working together, and we've seen this many times in the past. Political parties working together to deal with challenges. So I think the priority, as I see it, is there's a lot of polarization in the world. And there's, in several big democracies like the United States, the polarization is reaching extreme levels. So this is affecting the efficiency of democratic processes, and often it's very difficult to make any progress at all. So then the question to me is, how do we address that polarization? How do we find mechanisms to reduce polarization and create safe spaces for dialogue and more informed dialogue? So this is why within Earth for All, we've been talking about citizens' assemblies on economic systems change, and thinking through what an assembly would be would be like, and how it could be a support tool for democracies, specifically around polarization and bringing sides together for in a safe place for dialogue. So that's I think that's one of the most exciting ideas here. There haven't been citizens' assemblies on economic systems change before. There's been several on climate change, and for example, the French citizens' assembly on climate change, on the very first day of the assembly, it's 100 people randomly chosen to representative grouping of French society. They came together, they all sat at tables, they were all given a task on the first day and to discuss, and every single table asked for more discussion and more deliberation on economic systems change. But the assembly wasn't designed to do that. It was just designed to look at the climate question. And we can see that in other citizens' assemblies as well. This interest in economic systems change, in new ideas on economics. A sort of post growth ideas, donut economics, mission economies. A new approach to the neoliberal mainstream economic model that many governments in the West have been following for the last few decades. And so that's exciting. So we see quite a bit of potential there. And we can see in my home country, Ireland, how the citizen assembly on abortion, for example, abortion is a hugely contentious issue, a very polarizing issue in Ireland. And then you have a situation where at that time the church had a very strong influence in the politics of the country too. So as citizens' assemblies on that issue were able to address some of that polarization and allow society to move on, to then have a referendum on the issue, and then to overthrow the ban on abortion. And this is huge progress, a huge shift in values for a country that the citizens' assembly certainly contributed to.
And I think we saw some kind of shift too, with although a small one and perhaps superficial, I think, at the last COP, where we had this movement among developing countries, especially the poorer ones, to the loss and damage compensation, right, for climate change. And although there was nothing agreed financially, and there's still a long way to go, it's a mindset, right, that I think was kind of changing, when people start at least to talk about the issue of compensation for developing countries, which may also, I think, would you agree, be perhaps key for a kind of global change, is addressing the kind of inequalities between the developing South, shall we say, the global South, and the rich industrialized countries?
Yeah, it was great to see that. That's probably the biggest success story, I think, from the last COP. And it was essential that it was discussed. And of course, the reason it has come up so highly now is, number one, the COP was held in Egypt, and that allowed more space for that kind of discussion to happen. But secondly, you know, over the last decade, the obvious risks, and not just risks, but impacts of climate change are now playing out. A few weeks before the Egypt COP, one third of Pakistan was underwater, and we can directly link the scale of that rainfall to climate change. You know, a warmer atmosphere holds more water. You know, it's actually as simple as that. And the CO2 in the atmosphere, most of that CO2 has been put into the atmosphere by wealthy nations. So the atmosphere is now holding more water, and we can expect more rainfall in these areas. So this is there's obvious direct links, and that justice issue must be dealt with, and it can't be ignored. It can't be ignored anymore, and not least, you know, with the 10% richest in societies, it's the wealthy in societies have the excessive carbon consumption, the luxury carbon consumption, who are most responsible for it. And then, the fastest rising source of emissions is indeed the 1% wealthiest in society, who are the people who are going to be least affected by these changes. That's a huge justice issue we must address.
And I think if we're talking about behavioural change and making radical changes to our lifestyle, it's probably actually the top 1%, perhaps top 5%, that actually have to make the most radical changes to that lifestyle to get this kind of transformation going.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, addressing wealth inequality will in some way help with that. Penalizing people with very high emitting lifestyles we need to change behavior there. So we need a carbon tax on luxury carbon consumption. This needs to be priced properly. As we look at how democracies will evolve this century, you know, if the high polluting, the wealthy in societies are seen to continue their behavior and actually have more extreme luxury carbon consumption type behavior, and everyone else is meant to either live with a burning world and reduce their own emissions, that will that drive tensions up, or will that drive tensions down? You know, we can take a pretty good educated guess on which way that's going to go. So we need to it's another reason why we need to address this.
Which kind of runs when we're talking about wealth redistribution and climate change, it kind of we're going back to maybe the first question, but I wanted to touch upon something related, I think, to your Twitter handle, which says optimist by nature or optimist. Your book, I think, and I know that in terms of every time you write, you always want to show there's optimism and reasons for that we can really see change coming. Perhaps as a last question, could you perhaps summarize why you're still an optimist? You've been dealing with climate change and you've seen all the frustrations over the last 20, 30 years in this world. And we've reached this point where we are reaching the kind of tipping points that are quite scary in terms of climate. So could you explain why, through perhaps the vision or the eyes of this book, of why you're still optimistic, and why the reasons to be optimistic?
So I am very optimistic, and the book has given me more hope for optimism, but I'm also realistic about that, and I'll get to the realistic side in a second. But maybe first with the optimism. You know, number one, you know, with these system dynamics models, we can look at how population evolves this century, how the environment changes this century, how governments can evolve, and investment in social services can evolve, etc. And I can see there's many opportunities, there's many mechanisms to make the world a better place. We're not out of time yet, and there is a good possibility that we can all live within planetary boundaries. And I think one of the biggest things with the book was looking at population. And, you know, a lot of the population scenarios from the UN, for example, have said, okay, we're going to be hitting, 10 billion people this century. We just crossed the 8 billion mark back in November this year. And we argue that, you know, big investment in education and empowerment of women could actually lead to population stabilizing below 9 billion. And that would be a major success story, and that is plausible through rapid economic development in the poorest countries, and I'm optimistic we can achieve that. And even with the scenario we're currently on, we call it the too little too late scenario, where we end up poverty more or less ends for most people in the world before the end of the century. But it happens a generation later than our giant leap scenario, where condemning a generation of people to extreme poverty. So I can see with the huge investments that are possible that we can get the kind of scenarios the giant leap scenario, and we can be more optimistic about the future. And as we dig into the economics as well. When we look at the global financial crisis and the global pandemic, how reforms or financial innovations, like quantitative easing at scale, in both the pandemic and the global financial crisis, those innovations were able to provide the rapid access to financial resources to people, to governments, at a huge scale. The IMF was able to release $650 billion in special drawing rights, for example, within 3 weeks during the pandemic, which was one of the biggest positive shifts to help minimize the damage from the pandemic. So we look at that kind of innovation and think, okay, we can apply this to climate and biodiversity. We can move from billions to trillions within a year or two. I'm very optimistic we could do that. If the right politicians brave enough to take the right decisions are in power now, and we can see. I'm optimistic that this year we move from billions to trillions. To be honest.
Well, thanks very much, Owen. That's been really instructive, very interesting, and great to end on a bit of optimism. Your book, Earth for All, A Survival Guide for Humanity, is in all good bookstores, all good independent bookstores, is what we always like to say too, if you can buy them there. But thanks very much.
Thanks, Alistair. Great to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International Idea on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.